Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today is one of a kind, a full-time newsroom public editor, or what used to be called an ombudsman, that person serving as the link between those who produce the news and those who consume it. We're talking this hour with Elizabeth Jensen, public editor at National Public Radio. It's her job to represent listener concerns to NPR journalists and explain to the audience how decisions are made. Jensen is worried about the slide in public trust of news professionals, and she sees her job as a way to bolster that trust through information, critiques, suggestions, and transparency. So let's hear from you right now. As an NPR listener, what comments, concerns, praise, and criticism do you have? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call in 1-800-892-6477. And Elizabeth Jensen joins us from NPR in D.C. And Elizabeth, thank you for being with us. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, I tried to describe your role there, but I'd love to hear from you. How would you describe your job to someone who had no idea what a public editor is?
I think you described it actually quite well. I might steal some of your lines. right. So I like to describe myself as a liaison between the news consumers, as you say, between the audience and the newsroom. I don't work in the newsroom. So I am completely outside that system. I have no authority, but I do make the newsroom aware of the concerns that the listeners have, the readers have. We have NPR.org as well. So I'm paid by NPR essentially to surface all the criticisms that come in, the concerns, things like corrections that maybe don't get made. And then I also explain back to the audience sort of how the newsroom works and some transparency as to why they're making the decisions they do.
So you are a staff member. Your paycheck is signed by NPR, but you're also an outside critic. It's a little bit awkward, isn't it, Elizabeth?
It is a little bit awkward. So you're paid to sort of not be friendly with your colleagues, if you will, which is a little bit tricky because I have great respect for the journalists who are my colleagues here. I think they really do a terrific job. And we're all on the same side. We're all working for quality journalism. I think the difference is that, you know, I criticize from the outside and they work from the inside.
So why do you think, Elizabeth, other newsrooms have eliminated this position? I remember when the Washington Post had an ombudsman, the New York Times had an ombudsman, big TV networks would sometimes have, you know, public editors or ombudsman, as it used to be called. But from what I read, you're now the only one.
Right. So the rationale that the other news organizations have given is that Twitter, social media, has really replaced the criticism function, if you will. Excuse me. If a news organization makes a mistake, that news organization is going to hear about it within seconds on Twitter. Twitter is very, very good for that kind of rapid response. A public editor has a little bit of a different function. So I'm in the newsroom in the sense that I'm in the building. I am on staff, and my job is more to sort of explain if something went wrong, to offer corrections, to course corrections, I guess I would call them, say, you know, you might want to think about doing this differently because the audience really is not perceiving the journalism in the way that you mean it to.
No, course correction. And Twitter. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the difference between course correction and, oh, sorry, we said someone was a Republican when they're really a Democrat?
Well, NPR has a corrections editor. We have a standards editor, Mark Memmott, who does a terrific job. That is not my role. I mean, I can pass along a correction request, but it's not my job to say this needs to be corrected. That's the newsroom's role. My job is more to say, you know, here's a good example. So NPR has been moving into more of a format of live interviews. This has posed challenges for the audience. I think in some ways the audience hasn't always heard the live interviews in the way that the newsroom would like them to. And so my job, I feel, is to say, you know, this is the way you're being heard. You need to think about this and maybe make some changes.
So broad issues of how the audience is perceiving the way that the news is presented, and less about, you know, again, you gave the capital of Missouri as the wrong place or something like that.
Exactly, exactly.
Just real quick, though, what are your thoughts about on-air corrections? Mistakes are made, especially when you're on deadline. I understand that. Mm-hmm. What's the policy NPR takes on issuing a correction on the air?
Well, they do very few of them, actually, and I have been critical of that over my years. So I've been here 4.5 years. I think that NPR needs to do more of the corrections on air. Their rationale is that the people who heard the mistake will not hear the correction. You know, people don't listen for 2 hours in general. Some people do listen to the full 2 hours of a news magazine, but the vast majority don't. So their point is that unless it's a major mistake, they're not going to correct it on air. That they do correct errors quite regularly, and I think they're very good about correcting errors, but they do it online in the at NPR.org under a link called Corrections. It's easy to find. If listeners and want to find the corrections, it's pretty easy. It's at the bottom. There's a link at the bottom of the homepage. But for transparency's sake, for best practices' sake, for just quality journalism, I think that the corrections need to be made on air. They disagree, so that's how the role works. So I can say what I think and what listeners think, and they get to do what they want.
That's interesting. So how does it work then, Elizabeth? There's an example right there. When you agree with the listener criticism, in this instance, you feel like on-air corrections should be made on air. You make a suggestion to the NPR team. And what happens next?
Well, you know, sometimes they will take my suggestions and sometimes they won't. So, you know, I have an on-air, I have an online column. so I sometimes like to say that you know, the role is based on the forcefulness of my argument, right? Can I marshal the argument? Can I make a forceful enough case on behalf of the audience that something should change? And, you know, sometimes it takes time. And they have made changes. Not just me, but, you know, to past ombudsman at NPR. You know, I've one of the examples is labeling of opinion content. I think NPR has made some changes in the past couple of years on the way that they label opinion content, for example, on in social media, based on things I've written.
So sometimes they agree, sometimes they disagree. The right. example of on-air corrections, you know, they disagreed with you on that.
Right.
But
right.
another example, Elizabeth, where, you know, you heard from an overwhelming number of listeners, you made your argument, you represented that listener concern, and changes were made based on what you presented.
one of the issues that I dealt with I guess a couple of years ago this started was there was a lot of misinformation. NPR has moved to a model of live interviews on air. So it used to be they would do tape reports. The news cycle is such that news is changing overnight, right? So you could sort of leave for the day at 6 p.m. and think that sort of one thing was happening, and then at 8 p.m. you'd have a tweet from the president and the news would change. And so NPR really moved to a model of doing many more live interviews. The problem was that in these live interviews, sometimes you would have a guest from the outside who was giving misinformation. And that's a problem because if the host doesn't catch the misinformation when it's said during that live interview, then you have the possibility that, you know, errors are going out and misunderstandings are left. And so I wrote a column saying, you know, NPR needs to figure out a way to really deal with this. And they did. They eventually found a way to, they now include, a lot of times when they do a live interview, they'll include 30 seconds or 45 seconds at the end, and they'll have the a beat reporter or, another correspondent from NPR who will come on and will say, hey, this is what I heard, or here's the context, or on the off chance that there was a mistake, then they can correct the mistake right there. So the correction, if you will, stays with the error.
So they're doing more live interviews on programs like Morning Edition because the news cycle moves so quickly. So that's the hope, is that you stay on top of this incredibly fast-moving news cycle that we're in now.
Right.
The problem you
seem
to be saying is, Elizabeth, for listeners, is they feel like they only hear one side. They hear the host sounding biased because the host is trying to ask pushback questions. Politicians sometimes say things that are stretching the truth, so to put it. So there's an attempt to at least mitigate some of those problems. What about moving back to those, you know, excellent NPR reported pieces on the news where they talk to, you know, two or three or four people and you hear from all sides? Why isn't there more of that? And then you won't have this problem with live interviews with, you know, partisan types.
Right. So that has been a debate inside the newsroom. I think there are some who would like NPR to do more of that. I think we've been tracking the number of live interviews, and it seems to have dropped off a little bit recently. But again, I mean, there are two reasons. One is that the news just really, in order to stay on top of it, it really does need to be live. I think the other rationale that they give is that radio is valuable exactly for its immediacy. And I understand that. It's, you know, we like to, it's live radio. We're here and you can react in real time. But again, you have to make sure that the journalism doesn't suffer as a result and that the facts stay the facts and listeners come away with a full understanding of the issue.
Yeah, and it's trickier doing it live, for sure.
It is trickier. Right. Everyone has to be on the top of their game.
All right. Let's go to our listeners, Elizabeth. And then I definitely want to ask you what you're hearing from people about what they want to hear more of on NPR, what they maybe want to hear less of. Again, Exchange listeners, it's your chance to talk with Elizabeth Jensen. She's NPR's public editor. She's been there for almost 5 years, acting as the listener liaison to the NPR newsroom. So here's your chance to give us your comments, observations, praise, criticism for NPR's public editor. Our number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And Elizabeth, let's take a call from Portsmouth, where Tim is on the line. Hi, Tim. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
And thanks for taking my call. So I have this wonderful story about the ombudsman for the Boston Globe, whom I knew very well years ago. I lived in Stratham, and I had a subscription to the Boston Globe delivered to the house every morning. Well, one day, one spring, I read this editorial that was particularly aggravating to me. It was about the daylight savings time, and that's a sensitive issue with me. I don't need to go into it any further. And I did the classic thing for the ombudsman. I emailed the ombudsman, who was a wonderful woman. I can't remember her name, and she'd worked for the Globe for a long time. And I said, what's up with this guy? He wrote this editorial. First of all, if you read the editorial, you would think that by an act of Congress, the whole astronomical alignment changed, and we actually did receive an extra hour of daylight when we went to daylight savings time.
So what response did you get from the ombudsman, Tim?
Well, I got a great response from the ombudsman, and she explained to me that the particular writer perhaps was not a morning person and did not care for, he actually complained about the sound of birds waking him up, and that he probably worked late at night because he worked for the newspaper, and the people at the newspaper worked late at night, and that's why he hated daylight savings time. Okay, that was great. A few months later, I had reason to call her because the Boston Globe, at this point, she'd given me her phone number. The Boston Red Sox won the World Series, okay? And here I was in Stratham, New Hampshire, and the paper never came. And I called up the ombudsman, and I said, the paper never came. The paper. The first time the Boston Red Sox won the World Series in like 100 years or whatever it was, and the paper didn't come. And she said, I'm sorry, Tim, but all the first editions went out and stayed in Massachusetts and were never shipped to New Hampshire. And 2 days later in the mail, I got first edition.
Wow, that is customer service, Tim. What a great call. You know, it just strikes me hearing him talk. Thank you so much, Tim, that you kind of have the opportunity to develop a relationship with listeners.
I do, and I actually love it. I have quite a few people who write me regularly. You know, we get 8,000, 10,000 emails a year, so it's not always possible to answer all of them. We do try to answer the vast majority of them. But I do love sort of hearing from people regularly. I love it when sort of we explain things to people and they'll write back and say, oh, I didn't realize that's, you know, that's how it works, or that's why you're doing what you're doing, or... yeah, that's one of the best parts of the job.
How do most listeners communicate with you? Is it still on email? Are you getting a lot on social media? Do people still call you on the old-fashioned telephone? How does it work?
Both.
All of the
email
above.
And not phone calls. We found that we just don't have the staff resources
sure.
to take phone calls. So right. So my office is me. We have an editorial researcher, Juliet, and a wonderful intern this summer, Liana, but. That's a lot of emails to be answering, just the three of us. So, and usually it's just two of us. So, we do have a phone line where people can leave a message, but, we're just not able to answer it and,
sure.
and to return phone calls.
But, well, I want to let our listeners know too, that we've got links on our website, today. So you can, if you want to be in contact with Elizabeth later, you can do so. Just go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You know, I looked a lot at your blog yesterday, Elizabeth, and it's so interesting to see the wide array of issues that you tackle. And we'll get into some of those in a moment. But just more broadly, judging from your columns, lack of trust in media overall seems to be a key issue for you. It comes up a lot in your writing. What do you think, Elizabeth, might help improve trust in media broadly or at NPR specifically? What do you think?
Right. So the numbers are worrying. The trust in media figures have been dropping steadily and reached a low a couple of years ago. I think it bounced back up a little bit in the past year or two. You know, there are best practices that a number of groups have been trying to enunciate that newsrooms ought to follow in terms of sort of maintaining that trust. It's things like having a corrections policy, which NPR does, having a public editor, which very few organizations do, but ultimately that speaks to transparency. So a news organization ought to be able to explain to its audience how they work and why they make the decisions they do.
Well, and again, that all boils down to your job. And coming up, Elizabeth, we'll get into some of the common critiques that you hear from listeners, the choice of language that NPR reporters use, the way certain words are pronounced, and then just more broadly, I'd love to hear from you what people say they want to hear more of, what they want to hear less of. All that's coming up, plus your questions and comments. So keep them coming, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. More with Elizabeth Jensen in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, NPR's public editor Elizabeth Jensen is with us. It's her job to represent the listener's voice in the NPR newsroom. And so, Exchange listeners, we're taking your questions, comments, concerns. What do you like? What don't you like about the way NPR covers the news? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Elizabeth, how do listeners feel about the balance of stories that they hear? The daily political news out of Washington versus the rest of daily life, you know, in the rest of the country. How do listeners feel about that these days?
Well, I think the emails that we get say basically they think there's too much Washington. We get quite a few comments from people who just really would like to hear less about the administration, sort of hear less of the news filtered through, the Washington view, if you will, and more from across the country.
You talked recently with the new senior vice president for news at NPR, Nancy Barnes. It was a post you did recently, and she said she'd like to, quote, dial back incremental updates, those are her words, the sort of drip, drip, drip daily politics of Washington, you know. So it seems like she kind of agrees with you there.
Right.
Or agrees with the listeners.
I think so. It's a hard balance. So it's easy to sort of say that in the broad strokes, but then comes down to, okay, are we going to cover this story or are we going to get criticized if we don't cover this story? It's true that when NPR does not cover some incremental update, I hear from listeners too. So it's not possible to satisfy everyone, and not everyone would make the same decision that the newsroom does or doesn't. I think that the goal, as I understand it from her, is to sort of focus more time on the, if you do less on the sort of little incremental stories, that opens up more time for the bigger stories.
Well, and she also said she wants more across the country emphasis, less, East Coast, West Coast, and really more placing people, reporters, editors broadly across the country. Because I'm guessing that's another critique you've heard from listeners, right?
Absolutely, especially from people sort of outside the Beltway, if you will, who really are interested in more news from their region. So NPR is been in the middle of, for the past couple of years, really working on bolstering the relationship between member stations, the newsrooms at member stations, and the national newsroom, which is based here in D.C., figuring out ways to get more reports from those local journalists on the air, on the national news magazines. They've done a lot of strong work with that, and I'm hoping to write about that soon. I think that it's a I'm a fan of the work that they've been trying to do, and I think it'll be good for listeners.
Well, and speaking of listeners, let's go back to ours here in New Hampshire. Elizabeth, Alex in Concord writes, sometimes when I tell people that I heard something on NPR, they say that they don't listen to NPR because it's so left-wing, or that I must be a liberal because I listen to NPR. Personally, Alex says, I see NPR as being nonpartisan. I think you tell the truth without spin, but not obviously everyone sees it that way. Is it a public editor's job to combat that perception? And if so, how do you do it? Alex, it's a great question. What do you think, Elizabeth?
Interesting. So we label all the concerns that come into our office, and political bias is the top concern that we hear about. What's been interesting to me in the past couple of years, sort of the numbers are almost equal, not quite. People who think NPR has a liberal bias and people who think NPR has a conservative bias, that they're not tough enough on the administration. So we hear it from both sides. That, of course, doesn't necessarily mean that NPR is doing something right if you hear it from both sides. But I do think it speaks a little bit to what we were talking about earlier. Not everyone hears every 2 hours of every news magazine. So NPR puts on 6 hours of live news magazine programming every day, between Morning Edition and Here and Now and All Things Considered. That's a lot of time to listen. So you're not going to hear every interview. And so a lot of times we'll hear from people who say, oh, you only talk to Democrats or you only talk to Republicans. Well, so we will send out links and we'll say, you know, did you hear this? Maybe you didn't hear this interview. Or we try to take sort of a broad view, if you will. At one point, we were getting so many complaints of this nature that we went back and tracked down 6 months worth of political interviews. We tried to figure out, you know, whether it was a Republican or a Democrat or something else being interviewed. And after 6 months, the numbers were essentially even. They were off by one or two. So, you know, NPR makes an effort to hear from multiple perspectives. It doesn't always work out maybe on a month-to-month or week-to-week or day-to-day basis, but over the long term, I think they really do make an effort to hear multiple perspectives.
So given that research that you just cited, and yet given the concerns that you hear from listeners, and you're right, you know, most listeners are not glued to their radio for 2 hours a day, what could NPR do on its end to at least signal, listeners, we hear you?
That's a good word, signal. I have suggested that one way to do it would be to just be better about saying, hey, you know what? We had an interview with a Democrat on this issue yesterday. Here's an interview with a Republican. Or you can find the wide array of perspectives on this issue at NPR.org. Just something to say on air. We are talking to multiple people with multiple perspectives, and we know you can't hear them all, but if you search them out, they're there.
So just a couple words, really, to let folks know. You know, last week when we spoke to a Republican operative, he said such and such. That signals to the listener, oh, they spoke to a Republican operative last week. Okay.
Right.
So simple little changes like that.
Right. And, you know, look, from the newsroom's perspective, each word counts. There's very little time. 2 hours sounds like a lot, but actually when you boil it down, it isn't always a lot of time, and they kind of cling to every sort of word and sentence and second of airtime that they have. I guess you would know that in radio. So.
Yeah.
So I understand why they don't want to always take time to say that.
All right, let's go back to our listeners. And again, the number here on The Exchange for you to talk with Elizabeth Jensen. She's NPR's public editor. Again, it's her job to serve as a liaison between NPR listeners and the reporters and editors who produce the news. It's your chance to ask her whatever you want to ask, make whatever comment or critique you have about NPR productions. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Elizabeth, back to the phones. Dave's calling from Henniker. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you, Laura, and welcome, Eleanor. Thank you for taking this time. I'm concerned about not the people, the wide range of opinions, the people who listen, but the general sense I have throughout the country that conservatives believe that NHPR, or New Hampshire National Public Radio, is liberal. And I'm wondering what has been done to survey people, not listeners, but the country in general, and then use something other than your radio stations to get the word out about this wonderful balance that I do believe it exists.
Really interesting, Dave. So, Elizabeth, you know, how do you reach those people who will not listen to public radio because of the bias issue that you raised earlier? That might be outside your purview, but it's a great question.
It is outside my purview. I like to think that my role is, to address these issues in the sense that you know, to the extent that people write and say they have concerns, or I'll do an interview. I do a lot of radio interviews around the country. I don't know how you reach non-listeners and how you counter that, but it's a tricky issue. So.
Well, Dave, thank you. And I know there are lots of people sort of on the marketing and audience enhancement end of the business who are definitely looking at the question you ask. So thank you very much. Jake writes in, he says, especially in relation to wars and foreign policy, media organizations act as stenographers for government power. They simply repeat government propaganda uncritically or allow guests to do the same. Hosts never seem to question false narratives. And often listening to NPR, it takes a listener to call in and correct a guest when the host should be calling it out. Jake, thank you so much for the email. And Elizabeth, is this something that you hear from listeners who contact you?
Right. So when I talk about political bias, that's exactly those who say that NPR has a bias towards conservatives, if you will, or towards power, I guess is this this listener is putting it. I would push back on that from my perspective. Listening to a lot of NPR interviews, I think the hosts do a pretty good job of pushing back. I don't think every interview is perfect. No one is perfect. No journalist is. Live interviews are difficult. You know, you have to be prepared, and I think the hosts are, but sometimes someone will say something and you know, you get in this sort of weird dynamic where you don't want to argue with someone on air because that's really not fun for the listener to listen to. I mean, you don't want to wake up to people who are simply arguing on the air. So the hosts have a tricky job to sort of respectfully push back. NPR's ethos is to be respectful to the people in interviews on the air. So it's a tricky job that the hosts have. I think they do try to push back when they hear something that's wrong. You know, every interview isn't perfect, but I think overall they do a pretty good job.
Well, I understand Jake's concern. It was certainly something that came up in the run-up to the Afghanistan war, that no one, you know, seemed in the media and outside seemed to criticize that decision. In
the run-up
to the Iraq war,
right.
There's a lot of media mea culpa afterwards. So,
sure.
Jake, you know, I definitely understand your concerns because this has come up in the past. So I really appreciate you writing in. And towards your point about, you know, saying hosts do push back, Nancy writes in, she says, I'm a great fan of NPR and the quality of the news. On occasion, however, there is an interviewer on the afternoon news show that is so dogged in their interview technique that it's almost offensive. I sometimes feel they are bullying the interviewee into whatever answer they want. It is not a technique that I expect from NPR. Nancy, thank you very much. And Elizabeth, you know, I'm guessing you hear this a lot, too, from both Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
Right. So there you go. It's actually a really good counterpoint to the earlier emailer. You know, it's a very, very fine line. So you want to hold the person you're interviewing to account. You don't want them to, you know, say something that's wrong or evade the question. How do you do that? That's in a way that's respectful. Without sounding like you're bullying, it's very tricky. And, you know, so for every listener who thinks it's bullying, I'll get another email who says, hooray. Someone, you know, you're holding the
Thanks for being
the
so
guest
tough.
Right, you're holding the guest to account. So it's a very tricky fine line, and people hear things differently. So I do hear that complaint quite a bit.
Well, Nancy, thank you very much for that email. Again, you can send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. Your comments, questions, concerns for NPR's public editor, Elizabeth Jensen, are welcome. exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, looking at your blog, Elizabeth, and there's a link on our website if folks want to check it out. One of the biggest critiques that you get from listeners seems to be just the choice of words that reporters use. They don't like the words chosen to describe a group of people or a situation. Mm-hmm. What issues, Elizabeth, seem to elicit this the most?
Oh, it depends on the...
Depends on the day.
It depends on the day, right. At the moment, we're getting a lot of... emails about the language around immigration. NPR has just a very broad policy that articulated again by the standards editor, not to use words that label people. So the NPR does not use the word illegal immigrant, right? So you don't call someone illegal. You can say they are in the country illegally. That is clear and that's accurate, but you're not labeling them as an illegal, if you will. So we're hearing a lot about that. I mean, not everyone agrees with that policy, but I think it's sound. You know, it treats people with respect while also describing their actions. Abortion, we hear a lot of concerns from both sides of the debate about abortion, about the language that's used. And I wrote a column recently just really articulating how NPR got to the standards it does use around abortion. You know, we hear grammar concerns. We hear when a person makes a mistake, grammatical mistake on the air, we'll hear from the listeners. So they like NPR to have strong grammatical standards, which I think is appropriate.
Sure, fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the language you use, and boy, we could spend a whole hour on that. Immigration,
right.
Abortion. You have posted, you know, long columns really diving
right.
into the thought process and the thinking and so forth. So that's there available for folks. I do wonder, Elizabeth, if it would be useful at some point to just for you to go on Morning Edition and explain why this is the way it is, or for Mark Memmott, who I think is in charge of setting these policies, for
he
him
is,
to go on Morning
indeed.
Edition or All Things Considered and just say, hey, folks, immigration's a hot topic. A lot
right.
of people are upset with the language that we use. Here's why. I mean, do you guys ever do that? You or Mark Memmott?
I do not. I find it a little awkward. I've been asked a couple times to go on the shows. It's a little weird for me to sort of go on a show where I'm also charged with being a critic, if you will. So I've always sort of said no. But Mark did. Occasionally, when I first started here, he was a guest on Weekend Edition Saturday, where he would talk about the language choices. I always loved hearing those. I think the listeners really, really appreciated them, and I wish they would do more of it.
All right. Well, here's another email from, this is Ray in Dalton, who says, I understand the need to present both sides to certain issues, especially politics, but when I hear certain individuals who are selected to be interviewed, I change the station.
Uh-oh.
I will name a few. Hogan Gidley, Assistant Press Secretary, and Representative James Jordan from Ohio. Ray says, what is the criteria for the selection process? Ray, there's a couple people that I hear routinely chosen as go-tos on Morning Edition or All Things Considered as well. And I've wondered about that, too. So thank you for the email. Can you shine some light on this, Elizabeth?
Right. I can't speak to those specifics, except that I would say that you know, NPR talks to the administration. They talk to the White House. They put in requests to hear from the White House about their perspective on an issue. And Hogan Gidley is a spokesperson for the White House. I'm not sure what this listener's particular concern is with him, but I think it's appropriate, certainly, to talk to the White House people. You know, a newsroom's job is to talk to the people who are making the decisions and ask them for their rationale. There have been some concerns and criticisms raised that there are some Congress people who are perhaps too often heard on some of the news magazines. It's, you know, part of that might be an issue of just logistics. So, you know, a newsroom can make a request, but you can't force someone to go on the radio.
Sure.
So, you know, you talk to the people who are available, and sometimes that means people who are willing to get up at 5 a.m.
All right. Well, we will talk a lot more after a short break. Thank you for that email. And we'll go back to the phones in just a moment. We welcome your comments, questions, praise, criticism for how NPR editors and reporters present the news. Because our guest this hour is Elizabeth Jensen. She's NPR's public editor. It's her job to be the liaison between you, the listener, and the NPR newsroom. So here's your chance. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
I don't win anything. That's not my thing.
I was shocked because I've never won anything in my life before.
Never won anything in my life.
I never won anything before. That's terrific.
No one ever thinks they're going to win an HPR Summer Car Raffle until they do. And this year could be your year. Don't miss out on three chances to win $2,000 in gas gift cards, not to mention $25,000 toward a new car of your choice. Buy one raffle ticket for $50 or six for $150 at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, Millennials in New Hampshire's Housing Market. We'd love to hear your experiences with this topic before the show, so send them in, exchange@nhpr.org, and then join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. This hour, NPR's public editor Elizabeth Jensen is with us. She's the link between NPR listeners and the reporters and editors who produce the news. So let's hear your questions, comments, or concerns. Send them by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Elizabeth, right back to our listeners. Let's go to Greg in Portsmouth. Hi, Greg. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. I'm a slightly left of center pro-life Democrat, and I listen to NPR all the time. But I also watch Fox News on television. I was kind of surprised the other day to see Mara Liasson on Fox News. I know this has been addressed online, but I was wondering if Elizabeth would comment on Mara Liasson's position kind of betwixt and between two worlds. Thank you.
Greg, thank you very much for calling in. Elizabeth, have you heard from others on this?
Sure. We do hear about that occasionally. I think my predecessor wrote a column about it. I have not written about it. Mara is an NPR employee. Let's be clear about that. Some people seem to be confused, and they think that she actually is a Fox employee. Excuse me. Her role there, as I understand it, is to be an analyst. So she's not giving opinions. She is really analyzing the news. There is a lot of sort of confusion about what is analysis and what is opinion. People do hear things differently sometimes, but NPR's policy is that its correspondents can go on other news organizations, appear on other, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, as long as they are not giving opinions, but they are simply analyzing their beats.
So that's a really interesting question and word choice there. Should reporters be analysts, or should they just report, this happened, this happened, this happened?
Right. So, excuse me. This is an issue over the years. There are a lot of, particularly with digital media and the internet world, there are a lot of places to get straight news. You can get an AP feed if you want. You can read the news. You can get your headlines on social media. You can get them on a push alert to your phone if you want to know just what happened. News organizations overall have moved to a model where they're doing much more analysis of sort of what does this headline mean? Why, this happened and what does it mean? What are the implications here?
Well, it's interesting. And Greg, I appreciate the call. And we got a similar email from Molly in New London, who says, I just want to chime in on the interview discussion to say that I really appreciate that in the last year or two, after an interview, the interviewer will frequently then talk to Mara Liasson or another analyst to have them bring out the salient details and also disagree perhaps with what has been said or the facts of what has been said. Mm-hmm. Molly says that's very helpful and it keeps the interviewer from having to argue with the person they're interviewing while at the same time giving the listener the benefit of analysis and the facts of the situation. So, Greg, thank you again for calling in and thank you for that email, Molly. Christina from Goffstown says, on the subject of those who say NPR is too left-leaning, which is something I hear a lot, something to consider is that many conservatives simply don't believe or approve of certain things that NPR treats as scientific truth, climate change being the easiest example. Christina says, I think it's a bit of a lost cause trying to appeal to them. However, I will say that a recent story about Trump's 4th of July spending was nakedly partisan, which deeply disappointed moderate listeners like myself. Thank you, Christina, for the comment. And I want to ask you what she says about the NPR treats climate change as scientific truth. You have written about this, Elizabeth, sort of talking about how you cover these issues, how you try to hear from array of views, but not engage in what's called false equivalency. So just give us a little more there, please.
Right. So false equivalency is when you're sort of giving equal time to views that aren't supported by scientific fact. So, I've only been here 4.5 years. I would say we did hear concerns that, a decade ago, NPR might have put on more what you would call climate skeptics, climate deniers. I can't speak to that. I don't know if that's true or not. But I'm happy to say that NPR does not do that these days and hasn't since I've been here. You know, the role of a newsroom is to put on facts and not confuse the audience with multiple facts and say to the audience, hey, you decide yourself what the facts are. You know, you can say you can decide what your opinion is on those facts, but the facts have to be very clear. So NPR, I think, works hard not to engage in that kind of false equivalence.
So how do you report on those people who are not concerned about climate change, who don't believe that it's happening? How do you provide the audience a full picture without engaging in, again, what you call false equivalency?
Right. So you can report on the fact that this undercurrent or these beliefs exist, but the, you know, you don't necessarily give them what's called a platform. I hear that a lot. So don't give a platform. Don't give an open microphone and unfettered access to the airwaves to someone who is going to share information that is factually incorrect.
Let's go back to our listeners. Reeve is calling from Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. I adore NPR. Listen to it constantly. And I think the biggest reason is because I really want facts. And you guys either have all the facts or make corrections and try. So awesome job. Well, the only area that I have a question about for you at the moment is repeatedly prior to the debates, there was all of the announcers were referring to the top three or four and then would say, and six others. And there are two ways that people get really elected, name recognition, money, and I'll actually add another, the understanding of their platforms. So when NPR says, and six others, I feel as though you have completely voted. And I know you don't mean to do that. I know that you really try to avoid horse race announcing, but I'm longing for more, first of all, naming all of the ones who've gotten that far, and secondly, give us analysis of their ideas. I haven't come up with a decision who I'm going to vote for yet at all in the primary. It will be a Democrat. We have a great many to choose from, but I want more understanding of their differences. I'd like analysis of the of Yang's universal basic income. I'd like a whole program on that so we can understand some of these positions.
So, okay. Reeve, I'm really glad you called. And just from the exchanges perspective and NHPR.
Oh, you do an awesome job.
I know this isn't satisfying, but there is a ton. There's a ton online, both from my show and also the newsroom. You know, looking at backgrounds, Rick Ganley's done a series of interviews with the candidates. We've had as many candidates as possible on. So that's not to put you off or say that you're wrong, but I do want to let you and everybody else know that there's a ton online. And also, with 20 candidates, I kind of want your ideas, Reeve, actually, as a listener. How do you suggest we give you the depth that you want and deserve, given that there are 20 people running, or 23, I think, at this point?
Well, I think... are you asking me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think you are in a difficult position with this many. I just think it's important not to pre-cull too soon by sticking to just the ones who already have the money for the and the name recognition. And a little bit of comparison. Many of them hold similar positions, and it's good to take that position. I think maybe cover an issue at a time, like education or the UBI or climate change. That would be huge to know what are their positions and who are they working with. So maybe if you did a little bit less individual candidate and a little bit more on this issue, who's standing where,
sure.
That would be
okay.
Helpful.
Well, Reeve, thank you very much for
thank
jumping
you.
In today. We really appreciate it. And boy, Elizabeth, 2020. Again, I know you're not the political editor, but I'm guessing you have heard similar concerns to Reeves that they don't want anybody at this point to say top candidates. It feels unfair.
Right.
There's 23, maybe 24 running, and it's still really early.
Right. No, it is a challenge for the newsroom, and And we have heard quite a few of these concerns. Specifically, we're hearing them from supporters of one candidate or the other. They feel that their candidate has not gotten sufficient airtime. To name the position of all 23, 24 candidates in a news story, that would take up the entire 3 minutes of the news story, the way the news magazines work. I'm not quite sure what the answer is. I would say that I also think it's early. It's very early. So the first primary is not till, what, February? Is yours at the beginning of February, right? The newsroom, I think, has been rolling out these interviews as they go along. So we had heard 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, we were hearing quite a few concerns that Tulsi Gabbard wasn't getting enough airplay on NPR. And NPR, just the politics podcast, just did an interview with her this week. And I think that, I don't know if that's in the feed already, but certainly the excerpts have aired on the radio, on the news magazine. So I my sense is that the newsroom is trying to get to people, and it's taking time. But you also want to be thoughtful, right? So you don't want to just have 2 seconds about what is their position on Medicare for All. You really want to sort of give that candidate their due and be able to go a bit in depth.
Well, and I appreciate the comment, Reeve. And, you know, I know it's not as satisfying to say there's a lot online or so right. on, but there is a lot of there are a lot of resources there if folks want to. Since you mentioned the NPR Politics podcast, and I'm a fan, I would like to ask you about podcasts in your role as NPR's public editor. How do you approach NPR-produced podcasts with that public editor hat on, Elizabeth? Because you've written that you have, quote, complicated feelings about podcasts.
Right. So the newsroom standard is that the podcasts have to hold to the same journalism ethical standards that all NPR content does. You know, the challenge is that there's a tone that's different, right? So people come to a podcast not expecting to hear a news magazine. They want to hear engaging conversation. Often it's a little bit more informal. You know, so sometimes you sort of slip, right? So the standards editor, I think, has the challenge, if you will, sort of saying, okay, fine, you can be informal, but you still need to keep to the language standards. You know, some of the newscasts some of the podcasts use music underneath their content. That is usually not done to enhance a news magazine interview. That is one area where I think he has allowed some changes. But, you know, it's difficult because you want people to listen, and they come with different expectations, but you also want to keep the NPR brand of journalism held to the same standard.
So podcasts from NPR are held to the same journalistic and ethical standards as any standard 4-minute story on Morning Edition.
That's right.
So some podcasts that I've listened to do include swearing, which we are definitely not allowed to do in broadcast. How do you feel about that? Yeah. How do you feel about the use of curse words in an NPR-sponsored podcast? Is that allowed?
I'm not familiar with, actually, any examples where they have. I'd have to go back and listen. The standards editor has made it pretty clear that the language standards are the same. So you can be more informal in your conversation, but if he has approved words that you can't hear on the radio, I don't know about it. I don't doubt you.
I'm not suggesting these are necessarily NPR podcasts. Widely. Yeah, I can't specifically say that where right. I've heard it is an NPR podcast. But I was just wondering what the standards were there.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, it's tricky. So we were talking about that in my office just yesterday. The pop culture has changed. There's things are a little bit more informal. The language has changed. How much does a news organization like NPR have an obligation to stick to the older standards, if you will? We get concerns. One of the recent concerns we had was NPR has run 2 pictures of Cardi B, the performer, on the website. And we got concerns from readers who thought maybe that the pictures themselves were inappropriate. You know, I think it's a question of sort of changing societal norms, and not everyone changes at the same time. So it's, you know, a newsroom has to balance all of that and stay on top of the pop culture without sort of offending other listeners and readers.
Well, getting back to this issue that I know is a big concern for you, Elizabeth, and again, that's the trust between the public and the media. Speaking generally, where do you think journalism has the most work to do when it comes to improving this trust between those who produce the news and those who listen or watch or read it?
Oh, boy. That's a big question.
Easy question as we close out.
Yeah, right, exactly. No, I do think that more news organizations would be served if more of them had the role of a public editor or an ombudsman. Transparency is huge. It's not going to satisfy everyone. And, some people just don't want to trust, right? So they are sort of hardwired just to be cynical about the news and the people who are producing it. But I think transparency goes a long way, and I wish more news organizations would adopt this role.
Your position as public editor for NPR ends in January of 2020, less than half a year away, so the clock is ticking. What's your advice for your successor, Elizabeth?
Oh, dear. it's a wonderful role. It's an overwhelming role. It's a lot. Listeners and readers have lots and lots of concerns, so... I don't know. I'll be anxious and happy to see what the new person brings to the role.
Develop a thick hide, maybe.
Well, that too.
Really fun talking to you, Elizabeth. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's NPR public editor Elizabeth Jensen. Before she became public editor about 5 years ago, she covered public broadcasting and media for the New York Times and the Columbia Journalism Review. Again, if you want to find links to Elizabeth's columns and her blog, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.